And our special guest tonight, Nick Redfern, and of course, we'll take your phone calls. A few more stories to go when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Nick, as we get more into this and take some calls, where do we get your new book, The Pyramids and the Pentagon?
It's available, well, the publisher's New Page Books, George, and it's available at all good online outlets and bookstores as well.
It's amazing what these online outlets are doing for the book sales these days, huh?
Oh, yeah. You know, I think it's sort of the way of the future, really. I mean, it's just the changes, you know, incredible changes in the last sort of 10 years, you know, in the publishing industry, all across the board, really, you know, that's so wholly reliant on the internet, you know, nowadays for sales.
Yeah, that's so true. Why were the Nazis so obsessed with the occult and ancient artifacts?
Well, it's pretty much, George, you know, the same that we see everywhere. It was a determination to try and see, you know, if there was a way of capitalizing on sort of ancient powers or technologies. And the Nazis kind of took less of a technology angle, but more of the idea that they were literally on the search for the powers of God, you know, and if they could harness them, they could use them against the Allies. For example, I mean, under Adolf Hitler in the Second World War, a large number of senior Nazis had sort of like a deep and unrelenting obsessions, you know, with ancient artifacts, mystical legends. One, for example, a man named Otto Rahn, who rose to a position of power in the SS, he was absolutely obsessed with finding the Holy Grail. And that the Holy Grail was said to possess sort of extraordinary powers. And Rahn's idea was, you know, if we could understand it and then use it against the Allies. And of course, thankfully, that didn't happen. But another sort of well-known Nazi, Heinrich Himmler, he had an absolute fascination, which sort of bordered on an obsession, with the stories of Atlantis. And he came to believe that the Nazis, as he, you know, as they sort of stupidly called themselves the master race, you know, he believed that they were directly descended from the Atlanteans. And a lot of money and effort was put into a search to try and find, you know, where the real Atlantis actually was. And the Nazis had this organization, it was called the Annenerb. It was basically the sort of ancestry angle of the Nazis, where, you know, they dug into this sort of deep, sort of rich history as they perceived it to be, that, you know, that made them all powerful. And certainly, had the war not ended, or had the Nazis, you know, not fortunately been sort of knocked back, they would have delved far deeper into all of this. But of course, you know, when the Allies, when we finally, unfortunately, got the upper hand, you know, Hitler then began sort of focusing more on sort of just fighting the war rather than going off on these alternative obsessions. But I mean, for significant periods of the war, you know, they were after the Ark of the Covenant, the Spear of Destiny, all sorts of different things like this, you know, basically to see if they could sort of literally sort of weaponize the power of God as they saw it against the Allies.
That's an amazing feat. I still think they're down at the Antarctica doing something.
Well, you know, I mean, there's absolutely no doubt that a significant number of Nazis, you know, did escape at the end of the Second World War. You know, a certain number was obviously also brought over to the U.S. with Operation Paperclip, you know, and integrated into the U.S. space program. You know, so in that respect, I think there's nobody doubts there's a bigger story of surviving Nazis. You know, it's how far sort of, you know, along the chain it goes, so to speak.
Nick, let's talk a little bit about, of course, what the future holds for this, for this kind of research. What's going to happen?
Well, you know, I think the research at an official level is going to carry on, because it's a trend that's been going on since at least 47, at the very earliest, with the Dead Sea Scrolls. And, you know, you can push it back further with the Nazis in the Second World War. You know, the pyramid stuff was 50s and 60s. You know, we go further then on with the face on Mars, and then, you know, the crop circles and the whole 2012 thing. So I think this, what we're seeing, is a response to governments taking an interest in a whole wide range of ancient phenomena, archaeological mysteries, etc., biblical puzzles, and it's still ongoing. Mm-hmm. You know, this is almost like it's almost like an ancient equivalent of the UFO programs that we know are secretly going on. You know, they're more instilled towards the present and the future. This is looking backwards for answers and information. And I think as long, I mean, the trend would seem to suggest that as long as they feel there's some sort of capital to investigating these things, it's going to continue. You know, had I not found anything sort of post-1955, you know, you could make a good argument that, well, they looked into the Dead Sea Scrolls and they did a few dabblings into Noah's Ark and then called it quits. But that clearly isn't the case. It's the exact opposite. So I think we're going to see more and more of it. And, you know, what I'm hoping, at least, with the book is that by primarily focusing on the Freedom of Information Act in its pages, it'll hopefully bring forth, you know, other sources, other data, other witnesses, and people who can fill in some of the fragments, and also offer us new, hitherto unknown stories about some of these investigations. And we can build a bigger picture of how, and more importantly, why government agencies are so obsessed with these ancient folklores and mythologies, etc.
Okay, back to the phones. Let's go to Phoenix, Arizona to get things going. Keith, go ahead.
Good morning, George.
Hi, Keith.
I wanted to first mention, it's amazingly how eerily close these new drones are starting to look like Skynet drones. But anyways, yeah. I was just curious. I was wondering, since maybe the you know, military might possibly have anti-gravity devices and stuff like that, I was just curious, why would they possibly be tinkering? Why would the Navy be tinkering with this new Mach 6 jet?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I think what a lot of this comes down to, Keith, more than anything else, is that, you know, there are certain agencies and departments within government, you know, there are hundreds of them, and a lot of small think tanks and scientific programs, and they don't always share data. You know, that's one of the ways in which governments keep secrets, is that they keep secrets from themselves as well, not just from us. You know, Agency A doesn't always share its information with Agency B. They don't even know maybe Agency C exists because it's so small and, you know, gets its funding through whatever sources. But I think also there's the fact that, you know, you could make the argument that even while we're working on highly advanced technologies, existing ones may always have a place. You know, it's kind of like even if we have anti-gravity technology and it becomes widespread, doesn't necessarily mean we'll never use helicopters again. You know, it's kind of like just because one technology supersedes another doesn't necessarily mean it totally replaces it. So, you know, I think that might explain why we're seeing one thing going on where it looks like, you know, we've also got something that could replace it and sure. It's far more advanced as well.
Joe is truck driving in Bishop, California, wildcard line. Joe, it's your turn. Hi.
Yes, sir. I'm fascinated always with the fact of the Ark of Covenant. I'm originally from Israel, Christian, born in Israel, and that thing fascinated me since the age of 7.
Mm-hmm.
I have a theory, though. This is not a thing from this planet. It was brought in from a different world. And remember, the Egyptians have a great power at one time. That's for the fact that they had it themselves. Mm. And then remember, Moses grew up in Egypt. And when the Israelites did the exodus from Egypt, the Egyptians followed them.
Mm-hmm.
Not to exterminate them or anything. They wanted the Ark of Covenant back. But they failed to realize that since the Israelites now possess the Ark of Covenant, they have the power, and that's how they drowned in the Red Sea. And I think right now the Ark of Covenant laying under the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Remember those orbs over the Al-Aqsa Mosque?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Al Jazeera photographer. It's actually on their website right now. There's a spiral-looking lights, multicolor lights above the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And I urge everybody to go look for them. It's really fascinating. If Al Jazeera, a reputable station or network, fascinated with that, that means something, George.
Well, there is something. Yeah. There's no doubt that was an incredible whatever it might be. Did you see that one, Nick?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I mean, you know, to me, this is just sort of, you know, more evidence that when people say, oh, we know all there is to know, you know, we clearly don't. So.
Do you think there's a separate department set up within government to hide all these things?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if it's one department or if it's a whole range of agencies, you know, sort of doing their own thing and sometimes coming together and sharing data and sometimes jealously guarding it. Although it could be, you know, there could be like a definitive sort of black box at the end of it all where, you know, kind of like the final stages of Raiders of the Lost Ark, where all these ancient artifacts, et cetera, are stored away.
It's just stored away. And they don't even know what some of them are. You
but
know?
I mean, the Ark of the Covenant, the caller spoke about, I mean, that is a very intriguing story. I mean, you know, this very weird box, if you like, that was basically built. It's supposed to be the repository for the tablets of stone on which the Ten Commandments were prepared. And when Moses was sort of given the instructions by God on Mount Sinai. Now, the Ark of the Covenant, rather than just sounding like some sort of, you know, safekeeping place for the Ten Commandments, it actually doesn't sound like that at all. For example, it was supposedly allowed for like a conversation with God, which, in other words, suggests it was like a two-way radio almost. People were warned not to get too close to it, you know, or they'd be sort of struck down dead. And this has given rise to the idea that perhaps, you know, it was sort of electrified in some fashion. You know, and the ancients back in those days would have perceived it as being the work of God or magic, you know, if somebody got close to it and died. But if they weren't necessarily properly grounded, you know, perhaps it was electrocution. It ought to be, you know, the Bible also talks about, a lot of people don't remember this or know it, but, you know, when the trumpet supposedly brought down the walls of Jericho, well, on the first day, the people actually walked around the walls with the Ark of the Covenant. So it may have played a role in that. And there's also a story about it pushing open the waters of the River Jordan,
mm-hmm.
as if it was some sort of really highly advanced technical device that, you know, only certain people were cleared to use or knew how to use. And there were, you know, dark warnings. If you get too close to it or touch it, you know, you'll be struck down or whatever. And when you look at all those issues together, it does sound like some sort of ancient machine in some capacity.
Well, it was an incredible device. You know, they used to talk about how people would die if they touched it. They'd get electrocuted.
Yeah, I mean the Bible itself actually talks about a number of accounts of people touching the Ark and literally being instantly killed. And what's more interesting is that, you know, this voice would boom out from the Ark. And what's really intriguing is that to avoid sort of being injured or killed, it told people to wear specific items of clothing, you know, and that's like a classic thing, you know, with sort of wearing like rubberized soles
like, yeah,
or
like
whatever.
Being grounded or something.
Yeah, like literally like being grounded, you know, with rubber soles, that kind of thing. And when you find that the Ark or this voice coming from the Ark warned people to be clothed in specific ways, that really does sound like, you know, there's a tie-in with electricity somewhere.
Let's go to Bill, Wild Curd Line in Auburn, Alabama. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
This has to do with your triangular spacecraft.
Okay.
That you talked about earlier. I'm 65 years old, and I've always believed in UFOs, but I've never, other side just seeing streaks in the sky, I've never really seen anything until about, I guess, 3 months ago. And on the way to work at night, when I go, I pass through these two huge fields up on kind of a hill that rises up. And I know it was about 10 o'clock at night, and I noticed coming from the north, it looked like one of these motorized hang gliders that these people build and fly, you know, one man little ultralight thing. But it was 10 o'clock at night, and all I saw was three lights in a triangular shape. And I thought, what kind of an idiot is flying at night? There's no runways, no airports around here. I know of nobody around here that flies these things. And I stopped, and it came across almost in front of my car, and I realized that between the lights, there was nothing. And there was no sound, no wind, no nothing. It was only about 40 feet off the ground, and it looked to be about the size of an ultralight, and it just disappeared to the south. And I was dumbfounded. I mean, I just, to this day, but I've always wondered about lights on spacecraft. We have lights on our airplanes for navigational purposes so another airplane won't run into it.
That's right.
And so you can find it. But these highly advanced spacecraft, they don't need navigational lights. So what are they doing with all these lights on unless they want us to see them?
That's a good question. Go ahead, Nick. What do you think?
No, that is a good question. I mean, you know, some people have suggested like a psychological thing where they want to be seen to sort of test us. I mean, a classic example is the Phoenix Lights in 1997. You know, there's a lot of debate as to whether it's some military project or extraterrestrials, but I think the one thing more than any other we can say about the Phoenix Lights is whatever the point of origin, it wanted to be seen because it was so clearly, you know, open in a large built-up area. So, you know, maybe there's that angle to it. But, I mean, the information about, you know, the three lights and the triangular formation flying at low level, you know, that's sort of classic what we hear in these flying triangle cases. You know, and it usually is just the three lights. And, you know, these things have been seen all over the place. And it's quite true, you know, that the fact that, you know, we do use lights in aircraft and things like that. But, you know, when we send rockets into space, you know, it's not like the space shuttle, as it, you know, goes into Earth orbit, has a couple of blazing headlights on full beam or anything like that. You know, not to be make light of it, but it mm-hmm. doesn't, because it's not, they're not needed. So, you know, that does make a sort of a suggestion maybe that these flying triangles are whether they're built by us or someone else, they are intended, I think, to be flown within our atmosphere, and they're specifically illuminated so they can, you know, see what's going on, etc.
I wonder, Nick, if the propulsion system has anything to do with the lights, or vice versa.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. I mean, we assume a light, you know, is for illumination and direction. Maybe it is a byproduct of the, you know, the propulsion system. That's actually a good point.
Yeah, you never know. Nick, would you give out your website for us?
Yeah, people can reach me at nickredfernsbooks.blogspot.com or nickredfern14.blogspot.com. And there's also a link at both of those to my Facebook page, and people can reach me there as well. And always happy and pleased to chat with people, answer any questions or share information, etc.
What's your next project, Nick?
I have another book out later this year, which is called The World's Weirdest Places. And it's also published by New Page Books, who did the Pyramids and the Pentagon. Basically, they asked me to write a book where I picked my sort of favorite top 25 weird hotspot places on the planet and do a chapter on each. So it's got places like Sedona in Arizona, Mount Shasta, in the to name two U.S. places, but sort of creepy area of forest in England, where I'm originally from, called the Cannock Chase. Various other places, one in India, Russia in the Caucasus Mountains, South America, all over the place, Canada.
I'm going to ask you, what is one of your weirdest places when we come back, Nick? Plus, we'll take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, the Coast to Coast store is up and running with all kinds of brand new gifts for you. Just simply go to our website, Coast to Coast AM. At the top and the bottom, click the, it says store, and take it away. You're going to really like the new items. We're going to come back in a moment with Nick Redfern and take final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Nick, what is one of the favorite weird places for you?
I think one of them, George, would have to be Halifax, Nova Scotia in Canada, which I have a chapter on in the book. And basically, that's sort of filled with a whole range of sort of weird activity. To give you an example, in 1913, when the Titanic disaster occurred, a lot of the dead bodies of the people who drowned on the Titanic, or, you know, in the waters, their bodies were taken to Halifax and stored there. And just a few years after that, there was a tremendous explosion in the harbour, which killed literally hundreds of people. And since with those two events combined, there have been numerous reports of sort of ghostly activity of people reportedly killed in both situations, whose bodies were taken, you know, to sort of makeshift morgues and that kind of thing. But on top of that, there have been a number of high-quality UFO encounters over Halifax. And I also talk in the book about in the 19th century how there was an entire wave of sea serpent sightings right off the port area of Halifax. So this is the sort of thing I've got in the book, where one area has been sort of hit by just a wealth of sort of paranormal weirdness, but in lots of different ways.
Okay, let's take final calls. Dan, truck driving in Iowa. Get us started here. Dan, go ahead.
Good morning, George and Nick. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing, Dan.
Hey, Dan.
Jordan, normally I try to get on and off as quick as I can, but if you would allow me, I have two questions tonight.
Okay.
The first one is, Nick, what is the upside of the government disclosing?
Okay. Do you want to answer ask the second one as well? I'll do them both together then.
Okay. The second one is I believe they already have disclosed involuntarily. When Neil Armstrong said on an open frequency that they were on the rim of the crater watching us now. I think we're asking the wrong question. We should be asking, what were we told that has kept us locked in the low Earth orbit for the last 60 years?
Well, in terms of what the government, you know, has to benefit from disclosing, I guess that depends on, you know, what it is they're hiding. You know, that's the most important thing of all. I think, you know, governments never do anything without a reason behind doing it, you know, which goes beyond just, oh, let's do it because it's the right thing to do. You know, there's always an agenda. And I think that would be relative to any sort of announcement that, yes, aliens exist and we've known about it for X number of years. I don't, unfortunately, see the government disclosing just because people demand it. If it's going to come, it's because the government foresees them gaining something from it. It's difficult to know what that might actually be. You know, I do sometimes wonder if the fear card could be played to sort of get us even further under control. You know, the idea that we're telling you because it's for your own good, because this is something else you have to worry about. You know, I think that angle, unfortunately, could be played by certain people that want to, you know, manipulate us even further. In terms of whether we already have disclosure, yeah, that's actually a good point, because, you know, you could argue that even though the government hasn't formally disclosed, the sheer body of evidence and wealth of data relative to UFOs in the public domain has already convinced, you know, probably possibly millions of people that UFOs are real. So whether the government formally discloses or not, the leaks and data that have come out have already convinced many people anyway. So.
Okay, thanks for that. Let's go to Miami, Florida. Steve's with us now. Hey, Steve, go ahead.
Hey, George and Nick, good morning to both of you.
Good morning to you.
As a first-time caller, George, I have to say that this is the most awesome show on the radio, I have to tell you that.
Well,
and
thank you.
I drive from Miami to Lancaster, Pennsylvania every month, and you keep me up all night, and I really appreciate that. But on to my question.
Sure.
Nick, I wondered, you know, I haven't had the pleasure of reading your book yet, but I'm definitely going to get it. When it comes to the Pentagon and the symbolism in Washington, D.C., and if you remember back obviously to the barrage of UFO sightings that happened there in the 50s or 60s, what was the most interesting? Did you come across any information or anything in your studies on that episode?
You know, I actually didn't, but only for the reason that I wasn't really able to add anything new to, you know, a lot of people have written about this already, you know, the idea of sort of you know, buildings and structures and roads, etc., that seem to be built according to, you know, sort of like Masonic imagery and that sort of thing. I mean, I know these stories. I just hadn't, you know, haven't been able to add anything new to it. But, I mean, you could argue that it is part of this picture because we're talking, you know, I talk in the book about the government investigating ancient mysteries. You know, many of these organizations, you know, their origins go back, you know, to the beginnings of early civilization. And to find, you know, these sort of roads that from, you know, aerial pictures that seem to suggest that certain areas of the planet and cities aren't just built at random, that they seem to have meaning in the design almost, you know, is intriguing. And I think there is something to it. I don't think it is all at random. You know, exactly what the meaning is, that's the bigger the bigger issue. But I have to confess, it's not something I sort of dug into in the book. But that said, I do think it's a valid one that, you know, there's a hidden meaning behind all that.
Okay, we go next to Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania, east of the Rockies, Thomas Stern. Hey, Thomas.
How you doing, George?
Good.
What's up, Nick?
Thank you.
I wanted to share a story that was handed down from a great uncle of mine. He was an avid big game hunter. He won a trip, like, in a lottery, and I half-funded it into Africa. I don't know the name of the tribal community, but they absolutely believe they are in possession of the Ark of the Covenant. And there's, like, armed guards that stand outside of this building. And because he was so inquisitive, he ended up being escorted away from this village. This is in the mid-80s, I guess. Have you ever heard of anything like this?
Well, there are a lot of places where, you know, the Ark of the Covenant is rumored to be hidden, if you like. I mean, one of them actually is in Ethiopia. Whether that was, you know, in relation to this story, I'm not sure. But you know, there are actually stories as well of, you know, the sort of like an ancient lineage that supposedly guards it, a lineage of people, and that they shift it around from place to place when anybody kind of gets too close, which would possibly make a lot of sense because, you know, it wasn't a huge structure. It was, you know, just a few feet in length and width and height. So, you know, the fact that there are a number of locations listed for it isn't necessarily anything out of the ordinary. I don't know this specific story, but I mean, I do know there are a lot of places that have been suggested, and, you know, maybe at one point or another, they've all been the place where it's been kept, you know, before it's been pushed onto somewhere else, as I said, when somebody gets hot on the trail or whatever.
Okay, Judith, Little Rock, Arkansas. Hi, Judith, go ahead.
Hi. I also lived in Phoenix, Arizona for 19 years, and I also saw the Phoenix Lights. Only this was with a friend, and it was the night before they were reported by other people. Saying that, you mentioned Antarctica. Antarctica is definitely a hot spot for UFOs. I was actually talking with some people about the wars in 2003, and I made some off-the-wall statement about I just wish all the wars would end and we could just have peace. And within a minute, a voice spoke into my right ear. It was a male voice. This was not a voice in my head. It told me that those were words that I needed to say, and I was told a number of things. I was told that they are 3 billion years ahead of us. Although some of the aliens, or call them whatever you will, are far behind them, I believe it's all coded into our DNA, just as we each person and every object has its own frequency. I believe that in December of this year, that frequency will be activated in certain people around the world. And they will also hear this voice. It's just like a receiver down in your ear. It's no different than talking face-to-face with someone. And I'm not a lunatic. I'm a well-educated person. And I've had many, many things happen to me. And my mother, 3 years ago, started having things happen with her. Orbs, and now she hears singing. And it's just like with me. It's in her ear, and the weird thing is my mother only has 20% hearing in that ear and no hearing in her other ear. And she can hear every word. Sometimes it's a choir. Sometimes it's someone playing a guitar or a violin and all different kinds of songs, gospel songs, sometimes silly.
What do you think the meaning of all of this is, Judith?
I'm sorry, what?
What do you think the meaning of all of this is?
I believe, like I said, that it's all coded into our DNA.
But why? Why is this happening?
Because they're here to help us and save us from destroying ourselves.
Boy, they better work quick.
Yes, I believe that certain people will be either taken away to a better earth. I don't think this is the only earth in the universe. That they are friendly. Some of them are not friendly, but the ones who are here to help us, they're the ones we will hear from in December of this year.
All right, we shall find out. Nick, I don't know if you want to react to that or not.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the things I would say, you know, the caller made a very good point about, you know, certain people being sort of assigned a role or a task. I mean, that's something that's quite prevalent throughout alien abduction stories, where the people feel that, you know, they have some sort of future task to perform. You know, that's very prevalent in these stories. And, you know, they don't seem to know what it is. It's almost like one of those things where it's on the tip of your tongue, but you're not able to quite recall it. And a lot of people talk about that, but they feel that there's some mission that's planned for them, you know, so that could be a tie-in there.
Okay, we have time for a couple more calls. We'll go to Richmond, Virginia. Here's Casey's turn. Go ahead, Case.
Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for taking my call. Sure. And Mr. Redfern, I hope I have a kind of a two-part question, and I hope you can give me some kind of feedback on it. I believe I got this information from a video that I watched on YouTube. It's like a four-hour video. It's kind of a documentary. It's called, do you want me to say the name?
Yeah, go ahead if you want, sure.
It's titled, if you search, Want Your Mind Blown? Want Your Mind Blown? Watch this video.
Okay.
And that's basically what it's titled. But I think it was somewhere in there where I heard that, or I dreamed it up, I don't know, that there were visitors from extraterrestrial visitors that came and were basically harvesting gold that they were going to take back to their planet or wherever to repair their atmosphere. They were making it into fine particulates to repair their atmosphere. I don't know if that's a theory. That's part of my question.
Well, that was the Anunnaki theory of Zechariah Sitchin.
Mm.
Exactly.
Okay.
To a T.
So that has been theorized, and I did hear that somewhere then.
Yes. Yep.
So that's good to know. My second part of my question is, I kind of formulated off of that. We put so much worth into gold always, globally. And I've never really understood what that means or why. And, you know, even on our money, we have in gold, in God we trust. And, you know, it's only one letter off of gold. And also there have been people who have been analyzing these fibers that have been sprayed out of planes from these chemtrails, and also the fibers that are in Morgellons victims, I guess, if you want to call them victims. And they have burned them and found that there's, like, very small, it's like a microtubule with gold in the center of it. When they burn them, there's like a little, what I've heard called a payload of gold in the middle of them. And I was wondering if perhaps this could be some ancient technology that, you know, was passed on to us to help us repair our atmosphere, or maybe we're trying to with that technology. And
all right, well, let's get his reaction before the clock gets us here.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the first part of the question, yeah, I mean, I would definitely recommend you get hold of Zechariah Sitchin's books. But, you know, he wrote a number of very good books, which, you know, you can read them all separately. But, you know, if you read them all, you've got sort of the whole scenario. And that thing with, you know, with the gold was basically, you know, what he outlined or detailed, I should say. And Sitchin, you know, sort of made it very clear that this was sort of more like a, I guess, like an exploratory, almost like a mining operation in some respects, I guess you could call it, you know, in simple terms. And, you know, I guess sometimes we think if we're getting visited, it's always to come and see the good old human race. But, you know, it may be our resources as well. I have to admit, in terms of the second part of the question, I haven't really done much research into chemtrails and that sort of thing, although, you know, a lot of people have. So I truthfully don't know anything about that aspect, but certainly the, you know, the Sitchin angle, that's well worth looking into.
Yeah,
if you're interested in that.
That is huge. Portland, Oregon, CJ on the wild card line. Go ahead, CJ.
Yes, gentlemen, I'd like to thank you both for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I didn't hit the Powerball tonight, but I think I did all right getting through for the first time, so I'm pretty excited about this.
320 mil, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was my 320th call to get through. So, I was raised a Christian, at first a Catholic, and then I questioned my question. You know, the So I had some biblical questions that I remember asking. How did, you know, if Adam and Eve were in, you know, the very beginning, they were in the garden. And I said, and then Cain slayed Abel, and he left, and he found a wife. I go, where'd the wife come from? And anyway, I kind of got in trouble. So anyway, so I've been trying to broaden my thinking, you know, and think more outside the box. And recently, I just happened to, for the first time, see a picture of the planet Earth without water on it. And I thought that looked like the Death Star on Star Wars when they were building it. And it looked like a planet that had been nuked. And I thought, how could, it was just, it blew my mind that when I saw this picture of the planet Earth without the water on it, it just looked like, it's amazing that we can look like a sphere with so much decimation that's actually taken place under the
water. Well, strange as you say, CJ, and we're almost out of time. Nick, this planet might have been nuked before many times, huh?
Well, you know, I mean, there are a lot of weird large craters dotted around the planet, you know, that people, scientists sort of suggested due to meteorite strikes. Maybe they weren't, you know, maybe it was something else in the distant past.
Nick, good luck with this book, The Pyramids and the Pentagon. If it's anything like the way you presented it tonight, it's phenomenal.
Well, thanks, George. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Nick Redfern and his website, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It is Nick Redfern, R-E-D-F-E-R-N.com. Simple as that. Great guy. I met him in Washington, D.C. a few years ago at a Steve Bassett conference. And he's a delight in person as he is on the radio. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasour, Timothy Banal, Stephanie Smith, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.